New reports from the Kubi Institute have shown that there's been an urgent need to prioritise the health of transgender and gender diverse people, with more than half of the participants in the study having experienced sexual violence or coercion. Further to this, less than half of those who experienced sexual violence reported it or sought any form of help. We are joined by Mr. Teddy Cook, manager of the Trans and Gender Diverse Health Equity at ACOM and an adjunct lecturer at the Kubi Institute, to discuss these troubling statistics, how and why the healthcare system is lacking and what needs to be done next. Good morning, Teddy.
Good morning.
So I will admit, I had to look up adjunct lecturer. Can you explain to me a little bit about what you do in both with ACON and at the Kirby Institute?
Sure. And thank you so much for having me on.
It's a pleasure. Yeah.
So my role at ACON is Trans and Gender Diverse Health Equity. It's a new role that I was honoured enough to be able to step into earlier this year. And so this role is about implementing the recommendations that came out of our kind of action plan that is called the Blueprint to Improve the Health and Wellbeing of the Trans and Gender Diverse Community in New South Wales. We published it a little earlier this year, and in that document there is a very intensive to-do list, really, that is my role to be implementing across the state. And with the Kirby, because I have been sort of at this now for a little while in terms of improving how we understand the trans experience in data and kind of working to apply like a little bit of pressure to improve the research agenda for trans people, the Kirby Institute very nominated me to be essentially what is a sort of a role where I'm connected to the Kirby, and it's an acknowledgement of my work, which is lovely.
Okay. Fantastic, yeah. So what topics did the survey cover, the one we're talking about today?
Yeah, so the Australian Trans and Gender Diverse Sexual Health Survey, it asked a lot of questions, and we received one of the biggest samples of trans people ever sort of recorded in Australian research. And I think part of that was because most of the research team were trans. And so when we were...
Okay.
It's a big deal when a research project like this has a predominantly trans team of researchers, because our community feels like they can trust the process.
I was going to say, it seemed to me like a common sense thing, but possibly, you know, this is the first time they sort of did that, or the first time it was the largest sort of representation?
Most research about trans people is done by cis people or people who aren't trans.
Of course,
and,
yep.
Yeah, and so there's been a bit of a recognition that including people who have a lived experience is actually a really good idea and improves the way that people engage with the research.
Yes.
So we ask questions about the sexual orientation of trans people, the gender identity of trans people, how we engage in sex and who we have sex with, and then experiences accessing sexual health care, as well as asking people about their experiences of sexual coercion and violence, substance use, engagement in relationships, and how people access services. So it's a pretty broad research project that asks people questions that they haven't been asked either ever or in a very, very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And the findings were not surprising, to be honest. It's still quite shocking, even though, you know, we sort of knew that we were going to be seeing some pretty staggering outcomes, particularly in relation to sexual violence and also the experiences that people have when they're getting or wanting to access sexual health care, and also wanting to access gender-affirming health care such as hormones. We found in our sample that people reported... about half of our sample reported not being able to access the gender-affirming care that they wanted as easily as we hope that people should be able to.
Is this, Sorry, is this across all of Australia or was this a specific area?
This was across the entire country.
Okay, interesting, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, this is, again, not something that's surprising. You know, we hear across our community and through our own experiences that accessing gender-affirming healthcare is very, very hard for people, even though they do report extremely high satisfaction rates when they are able to access the care that they need.
Well, it's not easy. It makes sense, doesn't it? It really makes sense, yeah.
Yes, it's very true.
Yeah. So you, I'm not sure if you know this, I might throw your curveball here, did you see a difference between metro and regional? Was that sort of trends brought up in the study about that?
Yeah, it was interesting because we were able to, even though most of our sample, and unsurprisingly though, we're living in a metro area, we did get a good number of people living across regional, rural and remote areas. In fact, we had some in very remote areas. And we had specifically tried to target people who were living in the bush because that was really important to us to make sure that it wasn't just an inner city sample. And, you know, experiences were fairly common, though, across the board. Poor access to sexual health care, discrimination and stigma experienced within settings of sexual health care, poor access to gender-affirming care. But, you know, overall, though, our sample of trans people were actually, despite shouldering a pretty intense burden of stigma and discrimination, our sample is actually a pretty resilient bunch. We asked questions about, you know, people's mental health, and how people are feeling, and it was interesting to see that for those people who were able to access the care they wanted, their mental health outcomes were improved.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, our sample were a pretty robust bunch, which again isn't surprising. But I think we sometimes see we talk about the trans experience and trans people as being framed through this lens of being unwell or sick or mentally burdened, and actually, this survey shows us that trans people are really similar to cis people, even if we do have some unique barriers and needs. But when we're treated well, we fare well. And that, again, isn't surprising, but it's good to have.
It's a lot of common sense there. Do you believe, also, do you have an idea of why it's hard for people, for trans and gender diverse people to access the care, the type of care they need?
I mean, there's a number of different factors.
So many. I'm not expecting you to answer that all here. I assume it's probably also a lack of, I'm sure there's certainly a knowledge lack as well from staff, but also I'm assuming funding as well is probably an issue.
Yeah. I mean, trans people aren't reflected as a priority population across most health strategies, including HIV and sexual health strategies, particularly in New South Wales, but in many other states and territories as well.
Mm-hmm.
We've only just been recorded as a priority population in the national HIV and sexual health strategy, which is a really great start.
That actually really surprises me. Did it surprise you about how long that's taken to come to fruition?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't surprise me, but it is frustrating. And I think part of the reason is since we started thinking about trans people in research and in sort of public health data, and it's very slowly changing, but we capture or count trans people as being either, the way that we count all people recorded in public health systems at the moment is by asking gender as being either male or female or transgender. And so when we collect gender like that, it doesn't actually really give us much information at all, because it sort of positions trans people as being an entirely homogenous or non-binary even identity, when most trans people are just male or female, and there are plenty of people who are non-binary and they're sort of erased in all of this, and people who are just male or female and it's recorded. So it doesn't surprise me then that we're not showing up in the sorts of strategies and policies that respond to that sort of data collection, if that makes sense.
It does. I think you're on the back step as the minute you sort of take a pick up a phone? You're already sort of confused. Well, you know, how do you answer that question?
And it's difficult when we say, well, programs and services are needed, but the evidence base doesn't really show that, because the evidence base isn't really set up to show that anyway. But having this sort of research that we have now, and, you know, we published our sort of community-facing report of findings at Australia's biggest HIV and sexual health conference a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted, really, the first thing that we did to publish something back to community, instead of having, you know, a whole set of academic papers. We wanted to share, you know, the community were so incredibly generous sharing their experiences. And we asked, you know, questions that are sensitive and invasive. For the questions related to sexual violence, we gave people the option to skip that set of questions.
Okay.
And
we had about respectful, yeah.
Yeah, and we said, you know, the next questions we're going to ask you relate to this, and this is not something that is an easy thing to talk about, so if you feel like you can't or don't want to, then skip it. And we had about 100 people that did choose to take that option, but the vast majority of our sample did go through, you know, that set of questions. And you know, it's a terrible thing to have to ask people.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you're undertaking an analysis of the findings, it shows us that most trans people, you know, in this survey, and this is a big sample, 1,600 people, that most people have experienced at least one experience of sexual violence, and that most people have never shared that with anyone, and also that most people have experienced more than one type of sexual violence. And, you know, that is something that the way that we respond to sexual assault, the way that we think about sexual violence, trans people are not at all really included in any of that conversation at a state and federal level about how we respond to people. And you know, interestingly, in our sample, it was trans men like me and then non-binary people who are assigned female at birth who are most likely to have experienced mm-hmm. sexual violence.
Mm-hmm.
But non-binary people assigned male at birth, and trans women, while they experience lower numbers, were still shouldering a very heavy burden.
This is it's a tough topic. Is there anywhere I can direct people now if they have heard this and they feel like they want to speak to someone, to Lifeline, or do you have someone specifically that you direct trans and gender diverse people to?
I always encourage people, certainly Lifeline, but I think QLife is such an incredible and important service that is a national service that operates every day from 3 p.m. until midnight, and it's a dedicated LGBTIQ phone and web-based counselling service. And just either Google QLife or QLife.org.au, and that will take you to the website for more detail.
Thank you so much, Teddy. That was incredibly interesting, and thank you so much for sharing that with us. Please enjoy the rest of your Monday, and I really hope that there's some reform that comes out of this survey.
I feel hopeful. But thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. All right, that was Teddy Cook from both Kirby Institute and ACON. Again, if you've heard anything today that you feel uncomfortable about or you want to talk about as well, as Teddy suggested, there's QLife and, of course, Lifeline as well. You can give a call.